like to ask Dr. Benson, how would you define physical death? And another part to the question, I can understand the implications of growth with the psychological deaths that take place, you know, all along as you've described them. But in what way is physical death growing and expanding for the person who's died after he's dead? Somehow I'm missing you here a little bit.
Before you leave, let me make sure I understand the question. In what way is physical death an opportunity for growth after the person has died?
Well, I can understand the clinical illustration that you're using for a person who is fearful with a problem, and suddenly he's liberated from this.
Right.
But after a person has died, wherein is the growth? And then akin to that, how do you define physical death?
Right. Physical death, the actual definition of physical death is very much up for grabs right now. I heard a lecture by a man by the name of Dr. White, who's a neurosurgeon, who complicated the matter greatly because he happens to be a transplant expert. And it is possible, for example, to take dogs and transplant brains into a dog. A dog that is dying, for example, you can take the brain from that dog and transplant it into the healthy body of another dog and keep the brain going. The question is, did the dog die because you took the brain out? Or is the dog still alive because the brain's still alive? It's a terribly difficult question, and it's becoming a more important question since doctors, catch this word, doctors harvest organs. And they want to know when can they legally say that a person is dead so they can go in and get the organs they need to transplant. Right now, most people agree that temporarily, anyhow, we will call it death when you have a flat EEG for 12 hours. For all practical purposes, the old standards still hold. A person quits breathing and their heart stops. But there are many instances when there is minimal heart movement and some breathing, but the EEG is absolutely flat. And if it's flat for 12 hours, they will call that person dead. Now, as to what happens after death, I have not spoken to that because I'm simply not expert in that field. That would be ridiculous. I'm here, you know, as an expert in psychology and what happens to living people. And I simply have tried to make the point that death, even the misery of physical death, can in fact be seen and worked with by human beings as an instance of growth. If there's more that goes on after death, and most of us believe there is, that would really be something for the gentleman on my right and left to talk about.
George, when I think the questioner is saying when you use the word growth, you're calling us to envision a movement from one thing that we can picture to something else that we can picture. Like that biggest tree out there, or even the little one, if for some crazy reason, 40 years ago, that tree had decided, you know, not to shed its leaves, not to give it up when the fall came, we would say, okay, it stopped growing when it was 40 feet high. But now it kept on growing for 20 more years, and now it's 70 feet high. And I can at least envision 20 years ago, 40 feet high, 20 years later, 60 feet high. I think you're compelled to say something about, if not what happens after death, at least what's going on at that moment, so that we've at least got some fuzzy notion of what the after picture is, to contrast with the before, so that we can say, aha, your talk of growth, at least at that point, makes sense. I can make sense out of your talk of growth in the years up until that time, by letting go of this and moving then to that stage, while my EEG is still very erratic.
Two things. I'm very glad that you chose, because I think it accurately portrays your position, the example of a tree growing. The idea that comes across, and when you talk about death in the United States, I get a clearer picture of what you mean by growing. You mean getting bigger and better every day. Now, growth, and as a matter of fact, I have said in times I'm unhappy with Christian colleagues, but this is unhappily the way the Christian church sees itself. Christian church, I'm afraid, frequently sees growth as growing the way coral grows. Coral, you know, grows beautiful castles. It grows that way by excreting on itself, and the excrement hardens.
I think that's a dirty analogy.
Now, the kind of growth I'm talking about has nothing to do with getting bigger and better. It has nothing to do with being able to say marvelous things on the way out, although I have known a couple of people who have said marvelous things. I've known people who have suffered every bit as much as this man did and have in the last moments had, in fact, a joyous expression with that much pain, as a matter of fact. But it has to do with a qualitative change. It is not a matter of getting bigger and better. It is a qualitative change. And it has a great deal of resignation in it, a great deal of hopelessness, and it has in it something that you and I cannot plan, and we cannot rig, and we can't figure it, and we can't understand it, and we don't deserve it, and we struggle against it. It has in it change, transformation, and joy and goodness that comes to us from sources that we do not control, but to which we are willing to submit ourselves. I've seen that happen. I know it can happen. This was a very depressing experience because no one in this entire film was afforded the opportunity to go through a process which would have given them that chance. The only shred, there were two things in that film that offered just a little bit of chance to these people. The first were the two ladies with the booze cart, which seemed to me the most Christian thing anybody did in that whole film. Certainly it was a heck of a far sight better than that ridiculous doctor bombing around trying to be graceful. I thought at first when he said graceful, he was talking about grace, Christian grace. He really meant graceful. He meant sort of how nifty you can get from one room to the other, one cubicle to the other. How sort of like a ballerina, how beautifully you can do that. The Roman priest, who did in fact spend a few minutes listening, offered some chance, but obviously no real chance. The tragedy of that film, of course, is that no one in the whole picture was offered a chance to cry, to say, I'm dying, to feel hopeless, to express despair, to feel like it was worthless, to say, I have wasted my life cleaning my ceramic whatnot shelves, and to feel that, and to express it, and to die with it. But to find that in having expressed that to someone who would listen and to care about that, there can be change that makes all of that mistaken life a worthwhile thing to have gone through. That's the tragedy of this film. The tragedy of this film is not cancer. The tragedy of this film is not pain. You can go to the state hospital and see people who look every bit as bad as that, and they've got 30 years ahead of them. The tragedy of this film is not dying. The tragedy of this film is that no one was given a chance to make this thing into one more opportunity for them as human beings to reach the real potential that people have, the real potential which I believe the Christian gospel opens people to, and that is to see, even in this misery, the growth and the beauty of that which goes beyond us. Yes.
Do you see people doing that in any hospitals, in any of your work? Really?
No, I see incidences of it. I don't know any hospital. Doctors are dedicated to this nonsense. This good man, and I imagine he is a good man, feels like he's doing a good job by bombing around from one cubicle to the other saying silly things like you're looking better, or the sisters are taking care of you. When the sister is sitting at the end of the bed and the poor patient hasn't a chance to say, no, the silly old witch wouldn't even give me a glass of water last night. No, this poor man thinks he's doing a fine job, and that is habitual for physicians. It is habitual, I'm afraid, for a great many of the clergy. But there are incidences where there are people who are fortunate enough to have people around them who know how to care and how to listen, where things much better than this happen.
Dr. Benson, why don't you tell us what that change is or what that thing is that should have happened there? You keep talking about it, but you don't really tell us.
If you remember, the last part of my paper, I said that the joy that a person feels in death, people who try to describe it are usually maligned. When someone tries to interpret their words and when particularly when someone tries to interpret their words as a proof of one's favorite theory or fantasy. This is, well, I'll tell you of an incident I heard just the other day before I tell you the final thing I want to say. Someone was talking about the change that had occurred in their life, the movement, the growth, the new feelings, the experience, the joy, and the pain that they were aware of now that they'd never been aware of before. And they were telling this to a psychologist. And the psychologist says, where is your clinical proof? Where are the facts to support it? And all this person could say is, how can I prove it to you? I am it. This sort of thing, my friend, is not to be proven, nor even described. It is to be experienced. And that's really the essence of the Christian faith, it seems to me. It is an experience. And you can talk about it, and you can preach about it, and theorize it, and theologize it. And you can psychologize it, too, unfortunately. But you do not describe it. You either experience it and know something that is so individually, uniquely yours that it really goes beyond anything that you can tell anyone, or else all you've got are theories and theology and psychology, which really isn't worth much. Now, I can't do better than I've done to tell you what it's like. It is something to be known in sharing.
George, let me push you just one step more. If you say it is to be experienced, then I guess you would also be saying from the side of the practitioner, the pastoral practitioner or the MD practitioner, it is to be practiced. I guess that that's what the questioner was really asking. Given the fact that we had a 40-minute edited film, and so, you know, we've got just these snippets and snatches, and putting even the best construction on whatever we got, could you at least just point at one or two places where both physician or pastor or priest could at least have moved in this direction rather than that one?
Oh, I think the man, the star of the film, so to speak, was asking all the way through that film. Just look at that man's eyes and you could see he was dying to tell someone that he was dying. And no one ever said, you're dying. And no one ever stayed around long enough to allow him to say it. This man was really pleading with someone to listen to his expression of himself so that he could get out of himself and get beyond himself. And he was never really offered a chance to do that. As I say, there was one incident, and that was when the priest did sit still for a few minutes. Now, he may have tried more than that, but I really didn't see any chance. They didn't do it, but it seems to me that all the way through the film, we were looking at a man who was pleading for someone to listen. This was not a recalcitrant, bitter, angry man that is difficult to talk to and would shove you away and be mean to you. This man was pleading to be listened to, and you wouldn't really need an opportunity. You just come in and sit down for a while.
Are you saying then, and I think I read this in what you said this morning, because you started out with your appraisal of clergy and you did not become very specific, you made it very general. I think in that you were saying that we tend from time to time to become very insensitive to the people to whom we are ministering without, first of all, determining what their feelings are, their problems are, maybe even the stage in which they find themselves. You went through those five stages and you did not identify those as your own, but I assume that you were saying a person does tend to go through those five stages, and it would be important in ministering to a person to determine just where is he at this point, what are his feelings at this point. Now, my question is, you are not, I would imagine, questioning the method of ministering outside of the fact that you said it's very easy to fall into the pattern of using old cliches and not really ministering with meaningful words. Mm-hmm. Do I read you right?
Yes, but you had a question, and I'm not really clear as to what the question was. I mean, you're stating something that I feel and I believe, but let's hear the question.
All right, that really is my question. Are you saying that we are insensitive?
Well, I think
that clergy tend to become insensitive.
Let me put it the other way. That's certainly what you say on the surface is true. But I think it really isn't that way. I think we are terribly sensitive. I think clergy, probably in a very, very similar to physicians in this way, most of us get into the, quote, helping professions, unquote, because we're very sensitive people. But we find, when we get into our profession, that what we are required to be sensitive to frightens us, as indeed it frightens others. And we find ourselves trying to ward off a realization of the very thing that we've gotten into our business in order to be aware of.
All right, what if we are aware of it, and then we are faced with people who do not want to become aware of it?
But you left out a stage, you see. First is to be aware of it oneself. Then comes the lying awake at nights, and the fear, and the worry, and the anxiety, and the getting angry at the wife and the kids, and the trying to decide whether or not you perhaps made a mistake in a profession, perhaps you ought to be an advertising agent, and all the other things that go with the agonizing realization of what it's really all about. And when that is settled in your own mind, or at least you're in process of settling it, then you're ready to deal with somebody who doesn't want to face it either, or who perhaps is willing to face it but needs somebody who will face it with them. But that middle step is terribly important, and it's my experience that clergymen are really not very often introduced to that middle step. We're introduced to things about people where we don't get an awful lot in our education that suggests there are some dark nights to be lived through before what we have learned is operative.
In handling this problem of death, we feel a lot of inadequacies, and I wonder if it has something to do with our, I'm going to use the word culture for want of a better term. I think Dr. Ross said one place, he said 80% of Americans die in institutions. Now, if that be true, then most people are put into a place that is cut off from the regular way we live. I don't live, I hope my house is not an institution. It's not normal. And usually institutions aren't very normal. You have to be there at the right visiting hours, for example, you get kicked out. Therefore, there's something very artificial about dying. Maybe this is part of the problem. I don't know exactly what I'm going at here, but it seems that there's somewhere along the line we have institutionalized death in such a way, and I guess maybe this has influenced us as pastors too, because we're professional people and we institutionalize our ministry. Maybe we're in an institution, we'd be different if the person died in the home, is what I'm trying to say. And maybe we should get them out of that institution if they're going to die and get them in the house the last 3 days, let them die in the home where the kids are, so the kids can see what death is all about too, because our kids don't know what death is all about, so how do they know how to die? They don't know. We have removed this whole phase from them and isolated them and always say, Uncle Lenny just died. But they don't know what it's like. Therefore, they develop fears where I don't think that, you know, necessarily they would develop fears at all. Kids can take, you know, death, as you know, far better than we do. And there's a second thing that bothers me is how do you let a person die? We don't want them to die. When do you pull the tubes out? This kind of thing where I don't know. This is a mumble question, but I think it's something to do with our culture, something we're wrapped up in. Probably Ed can answer all those questions.
George said, do I want to handle it? I won't handle it, but I'll at least put a tentative hand or at least a couple fingers on it and just on a couple pieces of what I heard you say. It's easy to say, you know, our culture is the villain. There's a lot of things involved in that, one of which is, when I do it, it's a buck-passing thing. That's somebody else that I can point the finger at. And George, too, can say, look at those lousy physicians. And I can say, look at those lousy pastors. They, together with that whole frightfully noisy hospital, and apparently there's a subway running right underneath it, too, or something, all of the icky things that were in that picture, raised still for me, however, and I think for any Christian theologian, and that means any Christian pastor who seeks to be God's spokesman in different situations, raises still the why question, or, yeah, why? Why is that death so awful as we saw Albro Pearsall die? And, of course, I'm going to lead you right back to my paper, or to the thesis of my paper. The villain is not simply culture, or is not simply inept physicians who themselves have their hang-ups about death, or inept clergy who themselves don't really know how to do well most of the time. I'll draw an analogy from Luther in a letter about, or an article on fighting the Turk back in the 1520s, when he said the Turkish army is outside the gates of Vienna, and Charles V is calling all of us to rally around the flag and defend Christian Europe. But Luther said, we got to be aware, we Christians in Europe, of the fact that there are two enemies outside the walls of Vienna. One is the Muslim armies, and the other is our God. The real villain, the real nemesis, behind anything that finally kills, I said in my paper, is the Creator who is criticizing his sinners with the ultimate total criticism. Dust you were, and back to dust you go. That's not a benign word. It may, from George's perspective, indicate a kind of natural process, that's indeed the way the cycle of life goes. But there's nothing about that kind of statement or fact that would itself prompt any of us, I expect, to click our heels and sing a Te Deum. And I think George was pointing...
They've been doing it for 2,000 years. They've been singing a Te Deum precisely because of that.
No. As you yourself said, the reason we sing Te Deums is because of, quoting George Benson, of your last response, what the Christian gospel opens up for a patient, for a dying man. And what the Christian gospel opens up is not simply, in fact, is not at all, a different way to look at death. But it's a different somebody with whom to encounter death. Apart from Christ and his resurrection, St. Paul in Romans 15, in 1 Corinthians 15 says, there ain't no good news about death. Death is pure bad news apart from this curious surprise gift of God called Jesus of Nazareth crucified and risen. That's a rather fragile and thin piece of historical reality on which to hook your own life and self and open yourself up to. Some of you know Luther said it doesn't give securitas, it gives certitudo. It doesn't give security, but it does give us certainty, confidence. And that's the new thing that you yourself said is really in the mix, which makes possible all these glorious, joyful things that you said about death. Not simply that, as any psychoanalyst will tell you, death per se is a chance for growth.
To get back to the question of that, things would be better, I believe, if we were willing to pay the price, to give up our insulation and our isolation, and allow ourselves and our children to experience death and to see death. You ask the average parent of a child who's lost a parent early in life, what did you tell the parent when your husband died? They asked the widow. Well, we told Susie that Daddy was on a long trip. Why did you do that? Well, we didn't want her to be traumatized. Now, of course, the parent never stopped to think, what in the world is wrong with my father? This loving man whom I love and who loved me, and he went on a trip and just never comes back. Parent never wondered, of course, what kind of trauma does that do to a child? And it is a fiction that children can't take death. They most certainly can take death. It's the adults who have tried to insulate themselves from it that can't take it.
Could I just respond to the question of Pastor Meyer? It seems to me that one of the big lacks or the big deficiencies that Ambrose Pearsall experienced in this film
And also one of the overwhelming, I think, deficiencies that characterize a lot of what you call our culture today resides in the fact that while people constantly circulate among great numbers of other people, there's very little significant community among people. Consequently, there isn't that level and degree of trust and sense of safety contextualizing those communications which reveal and bring to the surface of consciousness with people the facts and the realities about death, especially in the case, for instance, of children. I think the unique solution to this whole dilemma is wrapped up in the mission and the ministry of the church.
Dr. Benson, the idea of death as an opportunity for change still intrigues me. Now, whether we think of change as something from smaller to larger or qualitatively, in any event, change implies at least sort of a before and an after. And if death is a change experience, then implicit in what you have said is something after death. Now, if this is so, would you care to say something explicit about this after death? And if you would, I suppose it would surprise me, not because you're an Episcopalian, but because very seldom do I find medical men even thinking about after death implicitly, much less explicitly.
Trafontaine and Boris, Ladislav Boris, these kinds of theologians have done a lot of work with the after-death business and the moment of death, the instant when eternity meets temporal life, and the whole notion of purgatory and the chance to make a decision, which these are interesting philosophical and theological ideas. I simply cannot get too hung up. I could get hung up. I'm not really willing to get terribly detained in my thinking about the temporal relationship. I suppose I could clear up the business of before and after by saying, of course, what I'm talking about is the contemplation and experience of death, not necessarily the actual act of dying. I mean, I'm not talking about my heart stopping, you see. I'm really saying that's unimportant, and I really can't see what reason a Christian would have for thinking it's important. It's important that your heart stops. What's important is the death, the very real death that one encounters every day in one's life. And when you become aware that you've got a malignant tumor or Hodgkin's disease or something of the sort, and you realize there is going to be a physical stop, all I'm saying is that also can be a stimulus for movement and growth. The fact that your brain is going to stop, that's where my paper will stop right there. I'm not saying that's the end of the road. There's an underlying difference between Dr. Schrader's paper and mine. And I may not be fair in my characterizing that difference, but I'll tell you the way I see it. Dr. Schrader refers to a thin fragment of history, a resurrection. And however shocking it may sound, I'd like to say I do not refer to that. I refer to a living resurrection that goes on in me. And if that is not going on, I don't really think that reference to the historical resurrection is terribly effective. The proof of the resurrection to me is not what happened 2,000 years ago, but what can and does happen in me today.
With regard to the time factor, we've gone over the 8:30 mark. It's been a long stretch.
Perhaps this deals somewhat with tomorrow's presentation, but in view of the film, in view of over the weekend I read the book by Elizabeth Kübler-Ross, interested in the ministry of those around the dying person, my fear is not that I might die, not that the person near me might die, but that I am incapable of that degree of sustained love and sensitivity that would serve that person. Or further, that in trying to serve that person, I become so involved in their pain that I end up sealing myself off from their pain by a degree of callousness. I suspect this is what you referred to earlier in the fright of the clergy, if I remember you properly.
Right. In response to that, I would simply cite George's analogy of the growth, and you'll never know whether or not you yourself will die as you enter into and involve yourself in the dying of another person. Though you'll never know until you try it. What I predict in most cases, if the dying has been an authentic dying with that other person, that you'll live on the other side of your dying with him. And I think this happens every day in the life of the average minister. It's just a matter of bringing it up to the level of observable consciousness with him. We don't evaluate ourselves enough and sense what's going on in the dynamics of our everyday service among people. I think if we did this, we'd be much more aware of the great time that we're having as we do it.
So you can have the last word, huh?
It never crossed my mind.
Never crossed your mind. I suppose there's no point in George and me continuing our debate, except I want to abjure his ascribing old line fundamentalism to me. The way I see it, the difference between us is I think death is much more a nemesis than George does. And because it is much more a nemesis, we need bigger resources to beat it than I hear George talking about. I say, as I read the scriptures, that the New Testament gives us big enough proclaims to us the big enough resources to do that. And that means for living resurrected life now. John's gospel is full of the fact that eternal life for Christians either happens now while you are living, or it never happens, period. I want to make one comment on the film, though, and that is, George said, in keeping with his own paper, the real tragedy was nobody listened to Al Breaux. And I'd agree with him 100% that that statement is true. I wouldn't call that the real tragedy. I'd say the real Christian tragedy is that nobody gave Al Breaux the gospel. Once more, we had an edited film, so we don't know. But the snatches that we got, even the listening priest, I think Alba was saying, yeah, your job is to listen, but damn it, your job is to help me. And just listening is not sufficient help, although it might be a step one for us being able to talk and you to receive my signals and to give me help. The sermon was very literally law. The first commandment, love God. The second commandment, love your neighbor. That's law. That ain't gospel. And the way the Eucharist was depicted, I think, is typical of what, way back in the 16th century, the Reformation said when the Eucharist is done, but not done, quote, according to the gospel. My judgment, then, on that film, my verdict is the real Christian tragedy is nobody gave Al Breaux any kind of gospel with which to meet the real nemesis that he sure was aware was encountering him, and which the whole film portrayed to us, not just that Albo is dying, but that whole institution was a tyrant on him.
To answer the question that was asked, I find it is the nicest and the most wonderful question to close my part of this work, because it's really very sincere. And you must certainly have listened to somebody if you know that you are very likely to fail in the job. But I would say you have a wonderful experience ahead of you, because someday, if you'll keep that up, you'll have the marvelous of experience of growing cold, of trying to insulate yourself, of cutting yourself off from someone whom you cannot bear to see die, and you'll have that person reach out to you and say, Pastor, let me help you.
And it is a marvelous thing to have a person who is dying help you to live. And if you'll just keep worried about it as you are, you'll have that experience.